Manchester architecture, 1973. All had a powerful, defining influence on the way engineers in the rest of the industry defined what disk drives were and what they could do. As IBM produced drives to meet its own needs, an independent disk drive industry emerged, serving two distinct markets. A few firms developed the plug-compatible market, PCM, in the 1960s, selling souped-up copies of IBM drives directly to IBM customers at discount prices. Although most of IBM's competitors in computers, for example, Control Data, Burroughs, and UNIVAC, were integrated vertically into the manufacture of their own disk drives, the emergence in the 1970s of smaller, non-integrated computer makers, such as Nixdorf, Wang, and Prime, spawned an original equipment market, OEM, for disk drives as well. By 1976, about $1 billion worth of disk drives were produced, of which captive production accounted for 50% and PCM and OEM for about 25% each. The next dozen years unfolded a remarkable story of rapid growth, market turbulence, and technology-driven performance improvements. The value of drives produced rose to about $18 billion by 1995. By the mid-1980s, the PCM market had become insignificant, while OEM output grew to represent about three-fourths of world production. Of the 17 firms populating the industry in 1976, all of which were relatively large, diversified corporations, such as Diablo, Ampex, Memorex, EMM, and Control Data, all except IBM's disk drive operation had failed or had been acquired by 1995. During this period, an additional 129 firms entered the industry, and 109 of those also failed. Aside from IBM, Fujitsu, Hitachi, and NEC, all of the producers remaining by 1996 had entered the industry as startups after 1976. Some have attributed the high mortality rate among the integrated firms that created the industry to its nearly unfathomable pace of technological change. Indeed, the pace of change has been breathtaking. The number of megabits of information that the industry's engineers have been able to pack into a square inch of disk surface has increased by 35% per year, on average from 50 kilobits in 1967 to 1.7 megabits in 1973, 12 megabits in 1981, and 1,100 megabits by 1995. The physical size of the drives was reduced at a similar pace. The smallest available 20-megabyte drive shrank from 800 cubic inches in 1978 to 1.4 cubic inches by 1993, a 35% annual rate of reduction. One study shows that the slope of the industry's experience curve, which correlates the cumulative number of terabytes, 1,000 gigabytes, of disk storage capacity shipped in the industry's history to the constant dollar price per megabyte of memory, was 53%, meaning that with each doubling of cumulative terabytes shipped, cost per megabyte fell to 53% of its former level. This is a much steeper rate of price decline than the 70% slope observed in the markets for most other microelectronics products. The price per megabyte has declined at about 5% per quarter for more than 20 years. The impact of technological change. My investigation into why leading firms found it so difficult to stay atop the disk drive industry led me to develop the technology mudslide hypothesis. Coping with the relentless onslaught of technology change was akin to trying to climb a mudslide raging down a hill. You have to scramble with everything you've got to stay on top of it. And if you ever once stop to catch your breath, you get buried. To test this hypothesis, I assembled and analyzed a database consisting of the technical and performance specifications of every model of disk drive introduced by every company in the world disk drive industry for each of the years between 1975 and 1994. This database enabled me to identify the firms that led in introducing each new technology, to trace how new technologies were diffused through the industry over time, to see which firms led and which lagged, and to measure the impact each technological innovation had on capacity, speed, and other parameters of disk drive performance. By carefully reconstructing the history of each technological change in the industry, the changes that catapulted entrants to success or that precipitated the failure of established leaders could be identified. This study led me to a very different view of technology change than the work of prior scholars on this question had led me to expect. Essentially, it revealed that neither the pace nor the difficulty of technological change lay at the root of the leading firm's failures. The technology mudslide hypothesis was wrong. The manufacturers of most products have established a trajectory of performance improvement over time. Intel, for example, pushed the speed of its microprocessors ahead by about 20% per year from its 8 MHz 8088 processor in 1979 to its 133 MHz Pentium chip in 1994. Eli Lilly and Company improved the purity of its insulin from 50,000 impure parts per million in 1925 to 10 parts per million in 1980, a 14% annual rate of improvement. When a measurable trajectory of improvement has been established, determining whether a new technology is likely to improve a product's performance relative to earlier products is an unambiguous question. But in other cases, the impact of technological change is quite different. For instance, is a notebook computer better than a mainframe? This is an ambiguous question, because the notebook computer established a completely new performance trajectory with a definition of performance that differs substantially from the way mainframe performance is measured. Notebooks, as a consequence, are generally sold for very different uses. This study of technological change over the history of the disk drive industry revealed two types of technology change, each with very different effects on the industry's leaders. Technologies of the first sort sustained the industry's rate of improvement in product performance. Total capacity and recording density were the two most common measures, and ranged in difficulty from incremental to radical. The industry's dominant firms always led in developing and adopting these technologies. By contrast, innovations of the second sort disrupted or redefined performance trajectories and consistently resulted in the failure of the industry's leading firms. The remainder of this chapter illustrates the distinction between sustaining and disruptive technologies by describing prominent examples of each and summarizing the role these played in the industry's development. This discussion focuses on differences in how established firms came to lead or lag in developing and adopting new technologies, compared with entrant firms. To arrive at these examples, each new technology in the industry was examined. In analyzing which firms led and lagged at each of these points of change, I defined established firms to be those that had been established in the industry prior to the advent of the technology in question, practicing the prior technology. I defined entrant firms as those that were new to the industry at that point of technology change. Hence, a given firm would be considered an entrant at one specific point in the industry's history, for example, at the emergence of the 8-inch drive. Yet the same firm would be considered an established firm when technologies that emerged subsequent to the firm's entry were studied. Sustaining technological changes. In the history of the disk drive industry, most technology changes have sustained or reinforced established trajectories of product performance improvement. One study, which compares the average recording density of drives that employed successive generations of head and disk technologies, maps an example of this. The first curve plots the density of drives that used conventional particulate oxide disk technology and ferrite head technology. The second charts the average density of drives that used new technology thin film heads and disks. The third marks the improvements in density achievable with the latest head technology, magnetoresistive heads. The way such new technologies as these emerge To surpass the performance of the old resembles a series of intersecting technology S-curves. Movement along a given S-curve is generally the result of incremental improvements within an existing technological approach, whereas jumping onto the next technology curve implies adopting a radically new technology. In the cases measured in the study, incremental advances, such as grinding the ferrite heads to finer, more precise dimensions, and using smaller and more finely dispersed oxide particles on the disk's surface, led to the improvements in density from 1 to 20 megabits per square inch between 1976 and 1989. As S-curve theory would predict, the improvement in recording density obtainable with ferrite oxide technology began to level off toward the end of the period, suggesting a maturing technology. The thin film head and disk technology's effect on the industry sustained performance improvement at its historical rate. Thin film heads were barely established in the early 1990s, when even more advanced magnetoresistive head technology emerged. The impact of magnetoresistive technology sustained, or even accelerated, the rate of performance improvement. Another study describes a sustaining technological change of a very different character, an innovation in product architecture, in which the 14-inch Winchester drive is substituted for removable disk packs, which had been the dominant design between 1962 and 1978. Just as in the thin film for ferrite oxide substitution, the impact of Winchester technology sustained the historically established rate of performance improvement. Similar graphs could be constructed for most other technological innovations in the industry, such as embedded servo systems, RLL, and PRML recording codes, higher RPM motors, and embedded interfaces. Some of these were straightforward technology improvements. Others were radical departures. But all had a similar impact on the industry. They helped manufacturers to sustain the rate of historical performance improvement that their customers had come to expect. In literally every case of sustaining technology change in the disk drive industry, established firms led in development and commercialization. The emergence of new disk and head technologies illustrates this. In the 1970s, some manufacturers sensed that they were reaching the limit on the number of bits of information they could pack onto oxide disks. In response, disk drive manufacturers began studying ways of applying super-thin films of magnetic metal on aluminum to sustain the historical rate of improvements in recording density. The use of thin film coatings was then highly developed in the integrated circuit industry, but its application to magnetic disks still presented substantial challenges. Experts estimate that the pioneers of thin film disk technology, IBM, Control Data, Digital Equipment, Storage Technology, and Ampex, each took more than 8 years and spent more than $50 million in that effort. Between 1984 and 1986, about two-thirds of the producers active in 1984 introduced drives with thin film disks. The overwhelming majority of these were established industry incumbents. Only a few entrant firms attempted to use thin film disks in their initial products, and most of those folded shortly after entry. The same pattern was apparent in the emergence of thin film heads. Manufacturers of ferrite heads saw as early as 1965 the approaching limit to improvements in this technology. By 1981, many believed that the limits of precision would soon be reached. Researchers turned to thin film technology, produced by sputtering thin films of metal on the recording head, and then using photolithography to etch much finer electromagnets than could be attained with ferrite technology. Again, this proved extraordinarily difficult. Burroughs in 1976, IBM in 1979, and other established firms first successfully incorporated thin film heads in disk drives. In the period between 1982 and 1986, during which some 60 firms entered the rigid disk drive industry, only four, all commercial failures, attempted to do so using thin film heads in their initial products as a source of performance advantage. All other entrant firms, even aggressively performance-oriented firms, such as Maxtor and Connor Peripherals, found it preferable to learn their way using conventional ferrite heads first, before tackling thin film technology. As was the case with thin film discs, the introduction of thin film heads entailed the sort of sustained investment that only established firms could handle. IBM and its rivals each spent more than $100 million developing thin film heads. The pattern was repeated in the next generation magneto-resistive head technology. The industry's largest firms, IBM, Seagate, and Quantum, led the race. The established firms were the leading innovators, not just in developing risky, complex, and expensive component technologies, such as thin film heads and discs, but in literally every other one of the sustaining innovations in the industry's history. Even in relatively simple innovations, such as RLL recording codes, which took the industry from double to triple density discs, established firms were the successful pioneers, and entrant firms were the technology followers. This was also true for those architectural innovations, for example, 14-inch and 2.5-inch Winchester drives, whose impact was to sustain established improvement trajectories. Established firms beat out the entrants. One figure summarizes this pattern of technology leadership among established and entrant firms offering products based on new sustaining technologies during the years when those technologies were emerging. The pattern is stunningly consistent. Whether the technology was radical or incremental, expensive or cheap, software or hardware, component or architecture, competence enhancing or competence destroying, the pattern was the same. When faced with sustaining technology change that gave existing customers something more and better in what they wanted, the leading practitioners of the prior technology led the industry in the development and adoption of the new. Clearly, the leaders in this industry did not fail because they became passive, arrogant, or risk-averse, or because they couldn't keep up with the stunning rate of technological change. My technology mudslide hypothesis wasn't correct. Failure in the face of disruptive technological changes. Most technological change in the disk drive industry has consisted of sustaining innovations of the sort described above. In contrast, there have been only a few of the other sorts of technological change, called disruptive technologies. These were the changes that toppled the industry's leaders. The most important disruptive technologies were the architectural innovations that shrunk the size of the drives, from 14-inch diameter disks to diameters of 8, 5.25, and 3.5 inches, and then from 2.5 to 1.8 inches. A previous table illustrates the way these innovations were disruptive. Based on 1981 data, it compares the attributes of a typical 5.25-inch drive, a new architecture that had been in the market for less than a year, with those of a typical 8-inch drive, which at that time was the standard drive used by mini computer manufacturers. Along the dimensions of performance important to established mini computer manufacturers, capacity, cost per megabyte, and access time, the 8-inch product was vastly superior. The 5.25-inch architecture did not address the perceived needs of mini computer manufacturers at that time. On the other hand, the 5.25-inch drive had features that appealed to the desktop personal computer market segment just emerging in the period between 1980 and 1982. It was small and lightweight, and priced at around $2,000, it could be incorporated into desktop machines economically. Generally disruptive innovations were technologically straightforward, consisting of off-the-shelf components put together in a product architecture that was often simpler than prior approaches. They offered less of what customers in established markets wanted, and so could rarely be initially employed there. They offered a different package of attributes valued only in emerging markets remote from, and unimportant to, the mainstream. One trajectory map shows how this series of simple but disruptive technologies proved to be the undoing of some very aggressive, astutely managed disk drive companies. Until the mid-1970s, 14-inch drives with removable packs of disks accounted for nearly all disk drive sales. The 14-inch Winchester architecture then emerged to sustain the trajectory of recording density improvement. Nearly all of these drives, removable disks and Winchesters, were sold to mainframe computer manufacturers, and the same companies that led the market in disk pack drives led the industry's transition to the Winchester technology. The same trajectory map shows that the hard disk capacity provided in the median-priced, typically configured mainframe computer system in 1974 was about 130 megabytes per computer. This increased at a 15% annual rate over the next 15 years, a trajectory representing the disk capacity demanded by the typical users of new mainframe computers. At the same time, the capacity of the average 14-inch drive introduced for sale each year increased at a faster 22% rate, reaching beyond the mainframe market to the large scientific and supercomputer markets. Between 1978 and 1980, several entrant firms, Shugart Associates, Micropolis, Prium, and Quantum, developed smaller 8-inch drives with 10, 20, 30, and 40 megabyte capacity. These drives were of no interest to mainframe computer manufacturers, which at that time were demanding drives with 300 to 400 megabyte capacity. These 8-inch entrants, therefore, sold their disruptive drives into a new application, minicomputers. The customers, Wang, DEC, Data General, Prime, and Hewlett-Packard, did not manufacture mainframes, and their customers often used software substantially different from that used in mainframes. These firms hitherto had been unable to offer disk drives in their small desk-side minicomputers because 14-inch models were too big and expensive. Although initially the cost per megabyte of capacity of 8-inch drives was higher than that of 14-inch drives, these new customers were willing to pay a premium for other attributes that were important to them, especially smaller size. Smallness had little value to mainframe users. Once the use of 8-inch drives became established in minicomputers, the hard disk capacity shipped with the median-priced minicomputer grew about 25% per year, a trajectory determined by the ways in which minicomputer owners learned to use their machines. At the same time, however, the 8-inch drive makers found that, by aggressively adopting sustaining innovations, they could increase the capacity of their products at a rate of more than 40% per year, nearly double the rate of increase demanded by their original home minicomputer market. In consequence, by the mid-1980s, 8-inch drive makers were able to provide the capacities required for lower-end mainframe computers. Unit volumes had grown significantly, so that the cost per megabyte of 8-inch drives had declined below that of 14-inch drives, and other advantages became apparent. For example, the same percentage mechanical vibration in an 8-inch drive, as opposed to a 14-inch drive, caused much less variance in the absolute position of the head over the disk. Within a 3 to 4 year period, therefore, 8-inch drives began to invade the market above them, substituting for 14-inch drives in the lower-end mainframe computer market. As the 8-inch products penetrated the mainframe market, the established manufacturers of 14-inch drives began to fail. Two-thirds of them never introduced an 8-inch model. The one-third that introduced 8-inch models did so about 2 years behind the 8-inch entrant manufacturers. Ultimately, every 14-inch drive maker was driven from the industry. The 14-inch drive makers were not toppled by the 8-inch entrants because of technology. The 8-inch products generally incorporated standard off-the-shelf components, and when those 14-inch drive makers that did introduce 8-inch models got around to doing so, their products were very performance competitive in capacity, a real density, access time, and price per megabyte. The 8-inch models introduced by the established firms in 1981 were nearly identical in performance to the average of those introduced that year by the entrant firms. In addition, the rates of improvement in key attributes, measured between 1979 and 1983, were stunningly similar between established and entrant firms. Held captive by their customers. Why were the leading drive makers unable to launch 8-inch drives until it was too late? Clearly, they were technologically capable of producing these drives. Their failure resulted from delay in making the strategic commitment to enter the emerging market in which the 8-inch drives initially could be sold. Interviews with marketing and engineering executives close to these companies suggest that the established 14-inch drive manufacturers were held captive by customers. Mainframe computer manufacturers did not need an 8-inch drive. In fact, they explicitly did not want it. They wanted drives with increased capacity at a lower cost per megabyte. The 14-inch drive manufacturers were listening and responding to their established customers. And their customers, in a way that was not apparent to either the disk drive manufacturers or their computer-making customers, were pulling them along a trajectory of 22% capacity growth in a 14-inch platform that would ultimately prove fatal. Another figure maps the disparate trajectories of performance improvement demanded in the computer products segments that emerged later, compared to the capacity that changes in component technology and refinements in system design made available within each successive architecture. The solid lines emanating from points A, B, C, D, and E measure the disk drive capacity provided with the median-priced computer in each category, while the dotted lines from the same points measure the average capacity of all disk drives introduced for sale in each architecture for each year. These transitions are briefly described as follows. The advent of the 5.25-inch drive. In 1980, Seagate Technology introduced 5.25-inch disk drives. Their capacities of 5 and 10 megabytes were of no interest to many computer manufacturers, who were demanding drives of 40 and 60 megabytes from their suppliers. Seagate and other firms that entered with 5.25-inch drives in the period 1980 to 1983, for example, Miniscribe, Computer Memories, and International Memories, had to pioneer new applications for their products and turned primarily to desktop personal computer makers. By 1990, the use of hard drives in desktop computers was an obvious application for magnetic recording. It was not at all clear in 1980, however, when the market was just emerging, that many people could ever afford or use a hard drive on the desktop. The early 5.25-inch drive makers found this application, one might even say that they enabled it, by trial and error, selling drives to whomever would buy them. Once the use of hard drives was established in desktop PCs, the disk capacity shipped with the median-priced machine, that is, the capacity demanded by the general PC user, increased about 25% per year. Again, the technology improved at nearly twice the rate demanded in the new market. The capacity of new 5.25-inch drives increased about 50% per year between 1980 and 1990. As in the 8-inch for 14-inch substitution, the first firms to produce 5.25-inch drives were entrants. On average, established firms lagged behind entrants by 2 years. By 1985, only half of the firms producing 8-inch drives had introduced 5.25-inch models. The other half never did. Growth in the use of 5.25-inch drives occurred in two waves. The first followed creation of a new application for rigid disk drives, desktop computing, in which product attributes such as physical size, relatively unimportant in established applications, were highly valued. The second wave followed substitution of 5.25-inch disks for larger drives in established mini-computer and mainframe computer markets, as the rapidly increasing capacity of 5.25-inch drives intersected the more slowly growing trajectories of capacity demanded in these markets. Of the four leading 8-inch drive makers, Shugart Associates, Micropolis, Prium and Quantum, only Micropolis survived to become a significant manufacturer of 5.25-inch drives. And that was accomplished only with Herculean managerial effort, as described in Chapter 5. The pattern is repeated, the emergence of the 3.5-inch drive. The 3.5-inch drive was first developed in 1984 by Rodyme, a Scottish entrant. Sales of this architecture were not significant, however, until Connor Peripherals, a spin-off of 5.25-inch drive makers Seagate and Miniscribe, started shipping product in 1987. Connor had developed a small, lightweight drive architecture that was much more rugged than its 5.25-inch ancestors. It handled electronically functions that had previously been managed with mechanical parts, and it used microcode to replace functions that had previously been addressed electronically. Nearly all of Connor's first-year revenues of $113 million came from Compaq Computer, which had aided Connor's startup with a $30 million investment. The Connor drives were used primarily in a new application, portable and laptop machines, in addition to small-footprint desktop models, where customers were willing to accept lower capacities and higher costs per megabyte to get lighter weight, greater ruggedness, and lower power consumption. Seagate engineers were not oblivious to the coming of the 3.5-inch architecture. Indeed, in early 1985, less than 1 year after Rodyme introduced the first 3.5-inch drive, and 2 years before Connor Peripherals started shipping its product, Seagate personnel showed working 3.5-inch prototype drives to customers for evaluation. The initiative for the new drives came from Seagate's engineering organization. Opposition to the program came primarily from the marketing organization and Seagate's executive team. They argued that the market wanted higher capacity drives at a lower cost per megabyte, and that 3.5-inch drives could never be built at a lower cost per megabyte than 5.25-inch drives. Seagate's marketers tested the 3.5-inch prototypes with customers in the desktop computing market it already served, manufacturers like IBM, and value-added resellers of full-sized desktop computer systems. Not surprisingly, they indicated little interest in the smaller drive. They were looking for capacities of 40 and 60 megabytes for their next-generation machines, while the 3.5-inch architecture could provide only 20 megabytes, and at higher costs. In response to lukewarm reviews from customers, Seagate's program manager lowered his 3.5-inch sales estimates, and the firm's executives canceled the program. Their reasoning? The markets for 5.25-inch products were larger, and the sales generated by spending the engineering effort on new 5.25-inch products would create greater revenues for the company than would efforts targeted at new 3.5-inch products. In retrospect, it appears that Seagate executives read the market, at least their own market, very accurately. With established applications and product architectures of their own, such as the IBM XT and AT, these customers saw no value in the improved ruggedness or the reduced size, weight, and power consumption of 3.5-inch products. Seagate finally began shipping 3.5-inch drives in early 1988, the same year in which the performance trajectory of 3.5-inch drives intersected the trajectory of capacity demanded in desktop computers. By that time, the industry had shipped, cumulatively, nearly $750 million in 3.5-inch products. Interestingly, according to industry observers, as of 1991, almost none of Seagate's 3.5-inch products had been sold to manufacturers of portable, laptop, notebook computers. In other words, Seagate's primary customers were still desktop computer manufacturers, and many of its 3.5-inch drives were shipped with frames for mounting them in computers designed for 5.25-inch drives. The fear of cannibalizing sales of existing products is often cited as a reason why established firms delay the introduction of new technologies. As the Seagate-Connor experience illustrates, however, if new technologies enable new market applications to emerge, the introduction of new technology may not be inherently cannibalistic. But when established firms wait until a new technology has become commercially mature in its new applications and launch their own version of the technology only in response to an attack on their home markets, the fear of cannibalization can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Although we have been looking at Seagate's response to the development of the 3.5-inch drive architecture, its behavior was not atypical. By 1988, only 35% of the drive manufacturers that had established themselves making 5.25-inch products for the desktop PC market had introduced 3.5-inch drives. Similar to earlier product architecture transitions, the barrier to development of a competitive 3.5-inch product does not appear to have been engineering-based. As in the 14- to 8-inch transition, the new architecture drives introduced by the incumbent established firms during the transitions from 8 to 5.25 inches and from 5.25 to 3.5 inches were fully performance competitive with those of entrant drives. Rather, the 5.25-inch drive manufacturers seem to have been misled by their customers, notably IBM and its direct competitors and resellers, who themselves seemed as oblivious as Seagate to the potential benefits and possibilities of portable computing and the new disk drive architecture that might facilitate it. Prairie Tech, Connor, and the 2.5-inch drive. In 1989, an industry entrant in Longmont, Colorado, Prairie Tech, upstaged the industry by announcing a 2.5-inch drive, capturing nearly all $30 million of this nascent market. But Connor Peripherals announced its own 2.5-inch product in early 1990, and by the end of that year had claimed 95% of the 2.5-inch drive market. Prairie Tech declared bankruptcy in late 1991, by which time each of the other 3.5-inch drive makers, Quantum, Seagate, Western Digital, and Maxtor, had introduced 2.5-inch drives of their own. What had changed? Had the incumbent leading firms finally learned the lessons of history? Not really. As the previous figure shows, the 2.5-inch drive had significantly less capacity than the 3.5-inch drives. The portable computing markets into which the smaller drives were sold valued other attributes: weight, ruggedness, low power consumption, small physical size, and so on. Along these dimensions, the 2.5-inch drive offered improved performance over that of the 3.5-inch product. It was a sustaining technology. In fact, the computer makers who bought Connor's 3.5-inch drive, laptop computer manufacturers such as Toshiba, Zenith, and Sharp, were the leading makers of notebook computers, and these firms needed the smaller 2.5-inch drive architecture. Hence, Connor and its competitors in the 3.5-inch market followed their customers seamlessly across the transition to 2.5-inch drives. In 1992, however, the 1.8-inch drive emerged with a distinctly disruptive character. Although its story will be recounted in detail later, it suffices to state here that by 1995, it was entrant firms that controlled 98% of the $130 million 1.8-inch drive market. Moreover, the largest initial market for 1.8-inch drives wasn't in computing at all. It was in portable heart monitoring devices. One study summarizes this pattern of entrant firms' leadership in disruptive technology. It shows, for example, that 2 years after the 8-inch drive was introduced, two-thirds of the firms producing it, 4 of 6, were entrants. And 2 years after the first 5.25-inch drive was introduced, 80% of the firms producing these disruptive drives were entrants. Summary. There are several patterns in the history of innovation in the disk drive industry. The first is that the disruptive innovations were technologically straightforward. They generally packaged known technologies in a unique architecture and enabled the use of these products in applications where magnetic data storage and retrieval previously had not been technologically or economically feasible. The second pattern is that the purpose of advanced technology development in the industry was always to sustain established trajectories of performance improvement, to reach the higher performance, higher margin domain of the upper right of the trajectory map. Many of these technologies were radically new and difficult, but they were not disruptive. The customers of the leading disk drive suppliers led them toward these achievements. Sustaining technologies, as a result, did not precipitate failure. The third pattern shows that despite the established firm's technological prowess in leading sustaining innovations, from the simplest to the most radical, the firms that led the industry in every instance of developing and adopting disruptive technologies were entrants to the industry, not its incumbent leaders. This book began by posing a puzzle. Why was it that firms that could be esteemed as aggressive, innovative, customer-sensitive organizations could ignore or attend belatedly to technological innovations with enormous strategic importance? In the context of the preceding analysis of the disk drive industry, this question can be sharpened considerably. The established firms were, in fact, aggressive, innovative, and customer-sensitive in their approaches to sustaining innovations of every sort, but the problem established firms seem unable to confront successfully is that of downward vision and mobility in terms of the trajectory map. Finding new applications and markets for these new products seems to be a capability that each of these firms exhibited once upon entry and then apparently lost. It was as if the leading firms were held captive by their customers, enabling attacking entrant firms to topple the incumbent industry leaders each time a disruptive technology emerged. Why this happened, and is still happening, is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 2. Value Networks and the Impetus to Innovate. From the earliest studies of the problems of innovation, scholars, consultants, and managers have tried to explain why leading firms frequently stumble when confronting technology change. Most explanations either zero in on managerial, organizational, and cultural responses to technological change, or focus on the ability of established firms to deal with radically new technology. Doing the latter requires a very different set of skills from those that an established firm historically has developed. Both approaches, useful in explaining why some companies stumble in the face of technological change, are summarized herewith. The primary purpose of this chapter, however, is to propose a third theory of why good companies can fail, based upon the concept of a value network. The value network concept seems to have much greater power than the other two theories in explaining what we observed in the disk drive industry. Organizational and managerial explanations of failure. One explanation for why good companies fail points to organizational impediments as the source of the problem. While many analyses of this type stop with such simple rationales as bureaucracy, complacency, or risk-averse culture, some remarkably insightful studies exist in this tradition. Henderson and Clark, for example, conclude that companies' organizational structures typically facilitate component-level innovations because most product development organizations consist of subgroups that correspond to a product's components. Such systems work very well as long as the product's fundamental architecture does not require change. But, say the authors, when architectural technology change is required, this type of structure impedes innovations that require people and groups to communicate and work together in new ways. This notion has considerable face validity. In one incident recounted in Tracy Kidder's Pulitzer Prize-winning narrative, The Soul of a New Machine, Data General Engineers, developing a next-generation minicomputer, intended to leapfrog the product position of Digital Equipment Corporation, were allowed by a friend of one team member into his facility in the middle of the night to examine Digital's latest computer, which his company had just bought. When Tom West, Data General's project leader, and a former longtime Digital employee removed the cover of the DEC minicomputer and examined its structure, he saw Digital's organization chart in the design of the product. Because an organization's structure and how its groups work together may have been established to facilitate the design of its dominant product, the direction of causality may ultimately reverse itself. The organization's structure and the way its groups learn to work together can then affect the way it can and cannot design new products. Capabilities and radical technology as an explanation. In assessing blame for the failure of good companies, the distinction is sometimes made between innovations requiring very different technological capabilities, that is, so-called radical change, and those that build upon well-practiced technological capabilities, often called incremental innovations. The notion is that the magnitude of the technological change relative to the company's capabilities will determine which firms triumph after a technology invades an industry. Scholars who support this view find that established firms tend to be good at improving what they have long been good at doing, and that entrant firms seem better suited for exploiting radically new technologies, often because they import the technology into one industry from another, where they had already developed and practiced it. Clark, for example, has reasoned that companies build the technological capabilities in a product, such as an automobile, hierarchically and experientially. An organization's historical choices about which technological problems it would solve and which it would avoid determine the sorts of skills and knowledge it accumulates. When optimal resolution of a product or process performance problem demands a very different set of knowledge than a firm has accumulated, it may very well stumble. The research of Tushman, Anderson, and their associates supports Clark's hypothesis. They found that firms failed when a technological change destroyed the value of competencies previously cultivated and succeeded when new technologies enhanced them. The factors identified by these scholars undoubtedly affect the fortunes of firms confronted with new technologies. Yet, the disk drive industry displays a series of anomalies accounted for by neither set of theories. Industry leaders first introduced sustaining technologies of every sort, including architectural and component innovations that rendered prior competencies irrelevant and made massive investments in skills and assets obsolete. Nevertheless, these same firms stumbled over technologically straightforward but disruptive changes, such as the 8-inch drive. The history of the disk drive industry, indeed, gives a very different meaning to what constitutes a radical innovation among leading, established firms. As we saw, the nature of the technology involved, components versus architecture, and incremental versus radical, the magnitude of the risk, and the time horizon over which the risks needed to be taken had little relationship to the patterns of leadership and followership observed. Rather, if their customers needed an innovation, the leading firms somehow mustered the resources and wherewithal to develop and adopt it. Conversely, if their customers did not want or need an innovation, these firms found it impossible to commercialize even technologically simple innovations. Value networks and new perspective on the drivers of failure. What then does account for the success and failure of entrant and established firms? The following discussion synthesizes from the history of the disk drive industry a new perspective on the relation between success or failure and changes in technology and market structure. The concept of the value network, the context within which a firm identifies and responds to customers' needs, solves problems, procures input, reacts to competitors, and strives for profit, is central to this synthesis. Within a value network, each firm's competitive strategy, and particularly its past choices of markets, determines its perceptions of the economic value of a new technology. These perceptions, in turn, shape the rewards different firms expect to obtain through pursuit of sustaining and disruptive innovations. In established firms, expected rewards, in their turn, drive the allocation of resources toward sustaining innovations and away from disruptive ones. This pattern of resource allocation accounts for established firms' consistent leadership in the former and their dismal performance in the latter. Value networks mirror product architecture. Companies are embedded in value networks because their products generally are embedded, or nested hierarchically, as components within other products, and eventually within end systems of use. Consider a 1980s vintage management information system, MIS, for a large organization. The architecture of the MIS ties together various components, a mainframe computer, peripherals such as line printers and tape and disk drives, software, a large air-conditioned room with cables running under a raised floor, and so on. At the next level, the mainframe computer is itself an architected system, comprising such components as a central processing unit, multi-chip packages, and circuit boards, RAM circuits, terminals, controllers, and disk drives. Telescoping down still further, the disk drive is a system whose components include a motor, actuator, spindle, disks, heads, and controller. In turn, the disk itself can be analyzed as a system composed of an aluminum platter, magnetic material, adhesives, abrasives, lubricants, and coatings. Although the goods and services constituting such a system of use may all be produced within a single, extensively integrated corporation such as AT&T or IBM, most are tradable, especially in more mature markets. This means that a study that has been drawn to describe the nested physical architecture of a product system also implies the existence of a nested network of producers and markets through which the components at each level are made and sold to integrators at the next higher level in the system. Firms that design and assemble disk drives, for example, such as Quantum and Maxtor, procure read-write heads from firms specializing in the manufacture of those heads, and they buy disks from other firms and spin motors, actuator motors, and integrated circuitry from still others. At the next higher level, firms that design and assemble computers may buy their integrated circuits, terminals, disk drives, IC packaging, and power supplies from various firms that manufacture those particular products. This nested commercial system is a value network. Another study illustrates three value networks for computing applications. From top to bottom, they are the value network for a corporate MIS system of use, for portable personal computing products, and for computer automated design, CAD. Drawn only to convey the concept of how networks are bounded and may differ from each other, these depictions are not meant to represent complete structures. Metrics of value. The way value is measured differs across networks. In fact, the unique rank ordering of the importance of various product performance attributes defines, in part, the boundaries of a value network. Examples in the same study show how each value network exhibits a very different rank ordering of important product attributes, even for the same product. In the topmost value network, disk drive performance is measured in terms of capacity, speed, and reliability, whereas in the portable computing value network, the important performance attributes are ruggedness, low power consumption, and small size. Consequently, parallel value networks, each built around a different definition of what makes a product valuable, may exist within the same broadly defined industry. Although many components in different systems of use may carry the same labels, for example, each network in the same study involves read-write heads, disk drives, RAM circuits, printers, software, and so on, the nature of components used may be quite different. Generally, a set of competing firms, each with its own value chain, is associated with each box in a network diagram, and the firms supplying the products and services used in each network often differ. As firms gain experience within a given network, they are likely to develop capabilities, organizational structures, and cultures tailored to their value network's distinctive requirements. Manufacturing volumes, the slope of ramps to volume production, product development cycle times, and organizational consensus identifying the customer and the customer's needs may differ substantially from one value network to the next. Given the data on the prices, attributes, and performance characteristics of thousands of disk drive models sold between 1976 and 1989, we can use a technique called hedonic regression analysis to identify how markets valued individual attributes and how those attribute values changed over time. Essentially, hedonic regression analysis expresses the total price of a product as the sum of individual so-called shadow prices, some positive, others negative, that the market places on each of the product's characteristics. Another study shows some results of this analysis to illustrate how different value networks can place very different values on a given performance attribute. Customers in the mainframe computer value network in 1988 were willing on average to pay $1.65 for an incremental megabyte of capacity. But moving across the minicomputer, desktop, and portable computing value networks, the shadow price of an incremental megabyte of capacity declines to $1.50, $1.45, and $1.17 respectively. Conversely, portable and desktop computing customers were willing to pay a high price in 1988 for a cubic inch of size reduction, while customers in the other networks placed no value on that attribute at all. Cost structures and value networks. The definition of a value network goes beyond the attributes of the physical product. For example, competing within the mainframe computer network shown in a previously mentioned study entails a particular cost structure. Research, engineering, and development costs are substantial. Manufacturing overheads are high relative to direct costs because of low unit volumes and customized product configurations. Selling directly to end users involves significant sales force costs, and the field service network to support the complicated machines represents a substantial ongoing expense. All these costs must be incurred in order to provide the types of products and services customers in this value network require. For these reasons, makers of mainframe computers and makers of the 14-inch disk drives sold to them historically needed gross profit margins of between 50% and 60% to cover the overhead cost structure inherent to the value network in which they competed. Competing in the portable computer value network, however, entails a very different cost structure. These computer makers incur little expense researching component technologies, preferring to build their machines with proven component technologies procured from vendors. Manufacturing involves assembling millions of standard products in low labor cost regions. Most sales are made through national retail chains or by mail order. As a result, companies in this value network can be profitable with gross margins of 15% to 20%. Hence, just as a value network is characterized by a specific rank ordering of product attributes valued by customers, it is also characterized by a specific cost structure required to provide the valued products and services. Each value network's unique cost structure is illustrated in another study. Gross margins typically obtained by manufacturers of 14-inch disk drives, about 60%, are similar to those required by mainframe computer makers, 56%. Likewise, the margins 8-inch drive makers earned were similar to those earned by minicomputer companies, about 40%, and the margins typical of the desktop value network, 25%, also typified both the computer makers and their disk drive suppliers. The cost structures characteristic of each value network can have a powerful effect on the sorts of innovations firms deem profitable. Essentially, innovations that are valued within a firm's value network, or in a network where characteristic gross margins are higher, will be perceived as profitable. Those technologies whose attributes make them valuable only in networks with lower gross margins, on the other hand, will not be viewed as profitable and are unlikely to attract resources or managerial interest. We will explore the impact of each value network's characteristic cost structures upon the established firm's mobility and fortunes more fully in Chapter 4. In sum, the attractiveness of a technological opportunity and the degree of difficulty a producer will encounter in exploiting it are determined by, among other factors, the firm's position in the relevant value network. As we shall see, the manifest strength of established firms in sustaining innovation and their weakness in disruptive innovation